Welcome to the C21 podcast. My name is Jonathan Webdale. In today's episode,
HBO said very clearly you can go and shoot King and Conqueror, especially considering you're an EP and you're developing it, but you must die.
As we look ahead to Series Mania in Lille next week, we hear from actor James Norton and Kitty Kaletsky, co-founders of Rabbit Track Pictures, about their new BBC historical drama King and Conqueror, among the shows spotlighted at the event. And
a lot of talk will obviously be about financing our project. I mean, the cost producing have never been higher than it is. So that's going to be part of the discussions, I guess.
Johannes Jensen, head of scripted business at Rabbit Track investor Banerjee Entertainment, details what else the European TV giant has up its sleeve and offers his take on the present state of the international drama market 3 months into taking up his latest post. But first, I spoke with Drama Quarterly editor Michael Pickard to get a flavour of what to expect from Series Mania this year and to get his thoughts on King and Conqueror and the inside line on his interview with the creative team behind it. Hi Mike, how's it going?
Yeah, very well, John. Thanks, how are you?
Yeah, great. Thank you very much. There's been a bit of a media scrum since our last episode featuring Philip Barantini, the director of Netflix teenage crime drama Adolescence. Star and creator Stephen Graham, the writer Jack Thorne, they've been all over the news. And I think the series even prompted questions in Parliament. So there's been a strong reaction to that series. I've watched the first two episodes, haven't got around to watching all four, I must admit, but it's very powerful stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, I've heard people have been binging it, which is probably quite a lot to ask for. I mean, I'm not sure I watched it in all, in one sitting. Certainly I broke it up a little bit, but it's an incredibly powerful story. It's hugely topical and timely, delving into this sort of toxic masculinity, incel culture that is sort of seems to live and spread online, and it certainly caught people out, I think, in terms of just how powerful the storytelling is. It's unfairly, having watched it, it's been unfairly sort of dubbed as the sort of the one take Netflix series, and it's absolutely an incredible technical achievement. But I think when you watch it, that very much fades into the background somewhat, because you are just swept away by fantastic script writing. The performances are incredible, and then that is all heightened when you think, oh, it's all one take. And it's great now Netflix are sort of releasing some of their behind the scenes footage. So you get to see, I guess it's choreography, for want of a better word, how all the crew are sort of charging around behind the camera, around the actors, to set different things in motion, to capture the camera when it's handed over between different operators, and attached to drones and put inside cars and things. It's on a storytelling level and on a technical level as well. It's a remarkable piece of television. And I'm sure we'll be hearing about it again next year when the BAFTAs roll around, and maybe even the Emmys. I'm sure if it has the same traction in the US as it has done over here.
Absolutely, yeah. I did have to keep reminding myself that it had been shot in a single take. And so it was really fascinating to have had those insights from Philip Barantini, the director, last week. So thanks for those. But we're not going to do another DQ review as such this week, because you're headed off to Series Mania in Lille next week. But we're going to talk about that event. Hear an interview with Johannes Jensen, who's the head of scripted business at European TV giant Banerjee Entertainment. And also hear from James Norton and Kitty Kaletsky, founders of Rabbit Track Pictures, in which Banerjee took a stake nearly 2 years ago, about their new historical drama, King and Conqueror, which is going to be among the hot new shows under the spotlight at Series Mania. So first of all, Mike, for the uninitiated, what is Series Mania?
Yeah, so for anyone in the scripted business, it's certainly a firm part of the calendar. It certainly has been for me since 2018, when I first started going to Lille, barring a couple of COVID years, of course. And then before that, it was a fixture in Paris as well. So there was a bit of an upheaval as it moved to Lille, but certainly helps the Brits traveling on the Eurostar. So that's it. So it's a great event for us to get to, certainly logistically. And it's a great event as well in Lille. It's for the uninitiated, it's basically a week-long TV festival. So that's where it differs perhaps from the other sort of more business-orientated events that we go to. 7 or 8 days of red carpets, premiere screenings, world premieres, local French premieres. years. And over the years, they've, you know, have attracted some top tier series from all the streaming platforms. And of course, there's a big French presence as well. They have an international competition, a French competition, and then there's various other categories that celebrate the best of international series. There's usually a student award. Lille's quite a big university town, so the premieres are always packed to the rafters with people who want to come and see the latest shows. So that side of the festival is always really popular. There's lots of masterclasses as well, and sort of various opportunities for people in the town to get up close and personal with some of the talent that's in town for the event. And then more for the business side, for 3 days in Lille, there is the Series Mania Forum, which is a bit more, I guess, a traditional business event with your panels and masterclasses and various different sessions. So it's really one for everyone, really.
Great. And you spoke with Francesco Capuro this week. He's the director of that sort of more business-focused strand, the Series Mania Forum that you referenced. So, you know, what did he have to say ahead of the event, and what are some of the highlights that he discussed?
Yeah, I think, you know, as all events tend to be, bigger, bolder, better each year. They've certainly got the room for it at the Grand Palais in Lille. It's an absolute cavernous venue that they seem to remove walls from, and it gets bigger every year. Certainly the last year or so, they've had more room for sort of a marketplace with more stands and stalls. So it's interesting that this year, for the first time, they're holding a buyers up front session on the Monday, which is, you know, takes place before the 3 day forum starts. So that's a new event where they're inviting 100 buyers to see 10 new series from around the world that they've been picked and wanted to highlight. And maybe it sort of steers away from the original DNA of Series Mania, which, like our own Content London, is very much on the development co-production side of things rather than a finished sales market. MIPCOM obviously would be the obvious example there. But this is, Francesco told me, is sort of a bit of a move to create kind of a one-stop shop at Series Mania. There was obviously a call from some of the exhibitors, some of the participants, for an opportunity to not just have those early discussions about shows 2 or 3 years down the line, but to get some of that finished tape out in front of customers and buyers who are going to be in Lille anyway. It's a hugely popular event with, I imagine, lots of buyers, acquisition execs in the halls anyway. So they've obviously sought to take a bit more advantage of that and get some finished tape out in front of people. So as always in Series Mania, it's a packed calendar, and we'll certainly be there trying to cover as much of it as we can.
Okay, and among the speakers that are sort of highlighted as the guests of honour, we've got among them Charlie Brooker, Christina Hendricks as well, the actress, Amanda Seyfried. Do you want to tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, so on the eve of season 7 of Black Mirror returning to Netflix, Charlie Brooker is going to be in town to give a bit of a masterclass on that series. How much he'll say, I do not know. In the past, when interviewing Charlie or anyone associated with Black Mirror, it's like pulling teeth often. So it'll be interesting to see what he does or will say about what's coming up, or even just reflecting on the success of the show and how technology in the real world has in some places overtaken or proved correct some of the things he's discussed in the show. So Charlie's, if you remember reading his Guardian newspaper columns well, back in the day now, he's a great character and a personality, so he's always worth listening to. Amanda Seyfried is going to be in town. Her Peacock series Long Bright River has just debuted, so she's in town with the showrunner to discuss that, which is screening during the festival. Christina Hendricks is also here for her Sky series Small Town Big Story, which is also being screened, and that show is going to be certainly one to mention by me when I moderate the Sky broadcast panel on the Wednesday afternoon. I'm going to be joined by the UK and Italian scripted heads, so we're going to get into a bit of Sky strategy Wednesday to find out what they're up to, and I'm certainly keen to find out what happens next in the Day of the Jackal. So if you want some answers, stand by for that one.
Great. Well, we'll look forward to hearing more about that in next week's episode. But as mentioned earlier on, among the shows that are being spotlighted is King and Conqueror. That's a BBC historical drama from Banerjee-backed Rabbit Track Pictures, set up by James Norton and Kitty Kaletsky. You spoke to them and Lindsay Martin, I believe, from co-producer CBS Studios about the series at C21's very own Content London in December. We're going to hear that conversation shortly, but just tell us a little bit about that show.
Yeah, so King and Conqueror, it's an epic historical drama, roundly based on the Battle of Hastings between King Harold and William the Conqueror and 1066. The rest is history, as they say, but notably the series that we will see coming to the BBC and other buyers later this year. I don't think it's a spoiler to say that it kind of builds up to that climactic battle, and the focus is very much on the relationship between Harold, played by James Norton, and William, the Duke of Normandy, played by Nicolas Costa-Waldo, and sort of discusses their rivalry and actually their friendship, as well as their families and their backgrounds, and sort of builds on those events that lead up to 1066 and the Battle of Hastings. So it's a huge epic series that was filmed on location in Iceland. It's a big international co-production led by CBS Studios, and the development partnership are involved, Shepherd Content, RVK Studios, and Rabbit Track Pictures, which is the company led by actor James Norton, who plays Harold, Kitty Kolesky, his business partner, and Kitty and James and Lindsay Martin from CBS joined us in December at Content London to have a bit of a deep dive into the show, where we had a world premiere clip of the series. So it looks every bit as impressive as you might expect. And yes, so in Lille, we're going to have a talent masterclass with James. He'll be joined by Kitty, as well as Banijay UK head Patrick Holland, and obviously Patrick will be in there to offer support, as you know, to explain Banijay's role in helping them build their slate. So it's a really interesting project. Obviously, James as an actor, I think there was a few weeks ago where he was cast in a new film or series almost every day. So he's certainly got enough projects on his acting slate, and it was really interesting to hear about his passion as a producer as well, certainly on King and Conqueror. Really intelligent guy, really, really fun guy. Kitty's great as well. Patrick's really fun. So I'm sure that one will be worth checking out in Lille.
Okay, thanks, Mike. Well, we'll be hearing your interview with James Norton, Kitty Kolesky, and Lindsay Martin shortly. But for now, I guess you better pack your suitcase and get ready to head off to Lille, where we'll be hearing more from you in next week's episode. Thanks very much, Mike.
Thanks, John.
Among those heading to Series Mania is Johannes Jensen, head of scripted business at Banijay Entertainment, the European TV giant which counts Rabbit Track Pictures among its interests, as well as having rights to the Black Mirror franchise, and owner of UK producer Kudos, behind the upcoming Stephen Knight Netflix drama House of Guinness we heard Mike referring to earlier. Jensen was promoted from head of scripted for Banijay Nordics to his present role in January, alongside Steve Matthews as head of scripted creative, following Christian Wikander's departure last year. He spoke with Neil Beatty about his priorities at Series Mania next week, the other new shows the company's bringing to market, and how he sees the scripted industry shifting this year and beyond.
Hello, Johannes. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Looking forward to Series Mania.
Are you a regular visitor to Series Mania, or is it your first time?
No, it's my second time going there, so it's kind of new. But I'm really looking forward to it.
What do you make of the festival? How does it differ to other kind of content markets, and what do you hope to achieve that?
In general, I think Series Mania started more as a creative market, more if you compare to a lot of others, where, you know, it's all bound to the creativity, project base, and creative discussions, which I think makes it stands out unique. Obviously, over the years, I mean, it's becoming more going towards a market as well. But I think since it have had that focus or started there, I think that makes a difference. That makes it, you know, it's as far as I understand, it's a lot of creative people coming from all around the world, which I think you also can look at some of the panels, some of the discussions that are made there. It's not always down to, you know, I need to finance my project. It's, you know, also looking into what's the new thing, what's the new trend, what's happening around the space. And we're trying to tap into that as well as Banijay. That's when it comes to our involvement. We have some people participating in panels, but also prior on the first day, we're trying to make having these kind of creative summits or scripted summits with our labels, and always trying to find where we think there are good interactors between us. So now we have a focus. In Gothenburg, we had a Northern European focus scripted, and now we are having that more of a Southern or Central Europe focus. I mean, it's going to be a lot of French and Italian and Spanish there, which is a great place, you know, where we discuss trends, we talk about new initiatives, learning from the industry together. And then obviously they're going to be probably going to announce a couple of news. But I mean, we have a Karem is one of the shows, you know, the new Apple TV Plus from Shine Fiction is going to be, I think it's on Friday, it's premiering. And then we have Vice and Morales, which I think is a very interesting show with the co-production between Spain and Germany. That's kind of one of the core thing. I mean, they're kind of some of the two main trends, you know, going for the big streaming product like Karemis, or, you know, the creative in how, both into the content, but also in how you fund shows like Vice and Morales, and also kind of a new co-production between Spain and Germany.
You mentioned yourself that, you know, obviously people at the festival will be talking about the trends and industry shifts going on at the moment. What do you think people will be talking about within the scripted industry at Series Mania? What are the kind of topics on people's tongues at the moment?
I mean, we're coming out from some years now, quite troublesome years with a big, you know, shift. But from what we understand, what we are feeling is like we're kind of leveling it out a little bit now. They were talking about, I think Ampere did some presentation both in Berlin and in Gothenburg about we're kind of 70%, 75% of the peak TV area, and it seems like it's stabilizing itself there. So it's a new world. We have to, you know, figure out how we are in this new world, finding new ideas, looking at co-production opportunities. We can see an increase, still increasing. I mean, we know the new world with streaming TV is continuous increasing. And also what I understood is, I would say they will be probably the biggest commissioners in terms of scripted content this year. Well, previously it's always been the commercial broadcasters. With that, having said that, for us, the traditional broadcasters still are the majority of our series. So that's still an important. But, you know, in terms of genres, I mean, I think crime has evolved itself many times over. So now crime is so many different type of genre. You can't just say crime is one genre. But what you can say is it still is kind of 40% of what's being commissioned is within that crime is either, you know, blue sky crime, or it's a thriller genre, or it's a comedy crime, or so many things of that. At the same time, I mean, we have had some great success with, you know, romantic series, the Culpa series on Prime. But again, I think it's a lot of talk will obviously be about, you know, financing our project. I mean, the cost producing is, you know, have never been higher than it is, even though it has dropped. So that's going to be part of the discussions, I guess.
Yeah, well, let's get into that, because obviously it's been a big topic of conversation in the last few months about high-end TV, HETV. There's been a whole government inquiry into it, with very senior executives in the UK saying it's almost impossible to fund premium TV because commissioners aren't giving as much money. And even if they've got a green light, production companies can't afford to make these shows by themselves. How do you see that situation?
I think UK has had the luxury of not being dependent on co-productions before, in the same way that many of the other territories are. And I think that's an area of at least finding some solutions to that. I mean, you can see the traditional broadcasters are dropping in their investment. At the same time, you can see that the global streamers actually have increased their, you know, investments into high-end premium series, which kind of offset a little bit. But again, no, obviously, it's always tough right now. It is just a challenge. I think, I mean, for us that have been working with co-production many years, we've also been having a lot of focused on tax incentives, where to produce, find the right partners, find the right stories that can resonate within more territories. I think that's still, we need to focus to have the best creative on board. We need to have the stories that both we aim to make it local success, but that can travel international. I think, you know, having attached some great talent to it will also help in funding projects. I think that's, you can see that over and over again. So I'm not that pessimistic. We have a great team, you know, under Patrick Hollands, but I would say that for us, this year coming up in the with the UK market, it's going to be the best UK scripted year that we have had. So that kind of says that there is, the market's still working, even though it's challenged and difficult.
Yeah. So what series from the slate of 2025 would you describe as premium TV, high-end TV?
So we have the House of Guinness from Kudos for Netflix. We have, yeah, obviously Rough Heroes is also, you know, running. Bergerac, I would say for UTV. And the Buchaners, we're going to do the season two. That's four source on Netflix. And then Wild Mercury's Fear on Prime. I don't know. I mean, Patrick was quite clear on, he believed in the scripted. Well, when he took over the regime, he invested in a lot in, we have the big production company. We also have a smaller build around talent. So a little bit of a catch-up effect right now for UK, Bandage Age UK this year. So it's going to be good. Obviously, then, hopefully we can, you know, build on that. I mean, some of them are event shows, but we're, you know, a lot of our DNA is looking to create shows that have a multiple season potential.
Let's talk about, a big part of your job is, you know, working with financial models to ensure the success of Banerjee's slate. Everyone's looking at new and innovative ways to put money together to help make the best shows they can. What are your current strategies as regards to that?
I mean, with a lot of the companies that we have, I think they feel quite independent. They're run by entrepreneurial CEOs that can its own markets very well. But then having the greatness or the opportunity of being part of this big group where we have some, you know, great strength. We have the number one distribution company within Banerjee Rights. We have invested and have a creative fund. The benefit of that is, like, we can go faster into some of the, you know, we can tap into the right creative. We can maybe finance a script ourselves. I mean, it's a little bit about time to market sometimes. So that's one part of it. We have, as you know, I'm sharing this role together with Steve Matthews, who's a great creative guy, and who, you know, when we started, he had this Banerjee boot camp with more of a aspiration, new writers, directors, creatives. But now we also, you know, kind of put that into productions or into development of things that we hope. So being part of this group, I think that's a big benefit. I mean, I didn't know when I tapped into it, because I have had the Nordic focus, that we actually were the number one large and production group also within the scripted field. I think it's 1,000 hours that we produced. I mean, that's a great strength. I think that's talking to all broadcasters or streamers, you want to have reliable partners going into. So I think we start with that, you know. Then obviously what we have to do in the center is tap into where is the great places to produce? Where can we find the best incentives? Who are the great, you know, line producer? How can we support each other? I think that's kind of a part of our mission that we have, to connect our group, because, you know, being very independent in one way and entrepreneurial driven, maybe you don't see the opportunities you have in the group. And that's kind of how we try to build it. And then I think also on the scripted format, I think that's something we can learn from the unscripted business. I mean, there has been created some great things that we, maybe being scripted producers, not always have looked into. But when it's, you know, when the times are a bit tougher, when these are, that's a great way to tap into and, you know, find the things that, you know, can shorten some of the development costs that you have.
Going back to that high-end TV thing a little bit, some of the producers were saying that one of the reasons why it's difficult to get those projects going is because it's difficult to attract US co-producers these days. Has that been your experience? Do you have to explore other territories?
Yes. I mean, this is not just, be totally frank, since I'm quite new into the role. And since the US is such a different market concept, but what I understood from our Banerjee Rights, you know, persons, and also our other colleagues over the US, that is right. It is a difficult market, you know, and obviously, especially for the English speaking market, that's a very important part to get the finance. So yes, that is a challenge.
Which other markets and territories are you looking at to kind of strike co-pro agreements?
I mean, where, from where I'm coming from, obviously, that's part of our DNA. We're doing a lot, and we're trying to, I would say, that's part of where we also want to try to export some of the knowledge that we have learned during co-productions. I think, you know, Spain, Germany, Italy, and France are other places where we are. And then, obviously, I hope and think that UK will come to, you know, will also start working more. I know there is an interesting collaboration between Germany and UK on several projects. So I mean, it's important not to forget, we cannot just only look at it as a financial instrument. You have to do it from a creative standpoint. That has to be in the front, because otherwise, I mean, historically we've seen some Euro puddings that didn't work that well, or that you lost that on the way. I think, you know, you need to have stories which adding another territory, adding other commissioners of that which in general, so getting more and more involved in actually the content, which I think is a good thing. They know what they need to have. And if we can find a good collaboration between that, I think that can sometimes, you know, make the project better.
And with that in mind, is Scandinavia and the Nordics still a very good place to collaborate with? I mean, obviously we had the Nordic noir trend. Things have maybe moved on a little bit. How do you see that? Speaking with your local expertise, how do you see the drama output from your region at the moment?
I mean, we have always been learned to, you know, work with small funds, small middle ways. And I think we are looking a lot into, I mean, we were at one time, we were have the luxury of being the one, only ones doing the co-production and working as well. Now, I think there's such a good creative environment from all the territories. So we're now looking a lot on other territories to get inspired. And, you know, I think the Blue Sky Crime, That's an area we some other, you know, churches were working into that field, and now we are doing a lot of those as well. Yeah, I think we had a kind of a double hit with the Viaplay, which a lot of other territories didn't have. They were the biggest commissioners. They stopped commission and then they start selling a lot of the things they had on the shelf. So it was a tough time, but I would say we're out of that right now. And I, coming from the Gothenburg Film Festival, I think when we were there in 24, that was really depressing, and a lot of people didn't have that much hope. Now we also, you know, feeling that it has stabilized, that we can find, and it's not only, as you said, Nordic noir, it's a lot of different other genres that we are tapping into. I would say we're kind of similar to a lot of the European corporate market in that sense. We still keep the Nordic noirs here. We love that, and we'll continue to do a lot of that, but with a new way of looking at a new twist to it.
And you've been in the job for just a few months now. What have been your main priorities and areas of focus in that time?
I mean, one of the things, obviously, to you know, take the Nordic hat off my head and tap into the whole getting the banjo rights, what are their priorities, start talking to our local labels. We have a great research team, which has a lot of intel, getting that into your body, and then trying to find models for us how to, you know, in the center, we will be a support team. You know, we will try to nurture wherever it's find path for a new creative way. And I think there's a lot of things already in place and built, but there are things that we can continue to focus on. And I think a lot of this is, you know, tap into all the intel that we have from all the world and be even more, you know, coordinating in how to we get that out to everyone and start building bridges between our labels, but also between the international partners.
And from the intel you've put together in those few months, so what have the key learnings or discoveries been that you've made?
I mean, apart from, you know, feeling that we have some hope in the future, that the streamers are not, I mean, even that there were some signs of some of them maybe moving out. I mean, what's great is that they now are profitable and start, and that's great for us. I mean, that gives us some security that they will continue to invest, even though they might invest some different type of genres or budget levels, but that's an important thing. I think our traditional broadcasters, there is many years still to come for them to continue. And they are also searching for new models. I mean, we can see how, for instance, in France, that TFR and Netflix suddenly are co-producing. I think that's models that I think are going to be creating, you know, more fuss around in the market, which will be beneficial for both of them and for us as producers. So I, you know, having, you know, having a sense of that stabilized, which is, it's in a good place. And, you know, I mean, what creativity is not just finding right stories, finding right talents. It's also, you know, finding the next way of leveraging on what we already know how to produce.
And with streamers starting to commission more content than broadcasters, has that inspired a shift in focus and strategy on your part?
I mean, it's clearly that Netflix has been, you know, doing very, very well, and they will continue to be the number one important streamer. I mean, just in terms of what we're doing right now, we do most for them. But again, I think both Amazon and Disney, depending a little bit on which territory you are, on some territories, they're very active, and some others, they are searching a little bit on how much they will focus on local content. And then it's going to be interesting for us to see where Max, now going back a little bit to some old HBO sense, which is, you know, my colleague Steve Matthews is very happy about that, because that's where he came from. But of course, I mean, Netflix is very dominant as a biggest global player currently.
And what kind of markets are you keeping an eye on around Europe and beyond? Where do you think might be the next kind of hot spot of drama or unscripted? Last question now, just looking ahead to the future when, you know, we've got the rise of AI, this YouTube is becoming a huge powerhouse. How do you rise to those? Let's call them opportunities rather than challenges.
I agree. I mean, for us, I mean, looking at AI, I think it's going to be a tool for the creatives to start with. I think there is several interesting things. Our Banijay France just released that a cooperation with one of those tools. And that's an area where we're really digging into right now. And I mean, also, obviously, in some efficiencies and also in terms of distribution, I think AI will support a lot, you know, keeping down the cost in distribution. You know, the YouTube, we need to invest more into that. We have more seen them as a big competitor, for many of us, especially in the scripted side. I think there's an opportunity there. And, you know, both for young talents, and we should be there. That's the hurdle to start creating content for YouTube is so, I mean, we've seen so much creativity inside that. We should really look into that. It's a great platform to kind of launch or communicate some of your series. So for me, it's, yeah, we should look at YouTube a little bit more.
Johannes Jensen speaking with Neil Beatty. Now, as discussed earlier, King and Conqueror is an upcoming historical drama from Rabbit Track Pictures, the production company set up by actor James Norton and business partner Kitty Kieletzki. It's a retelling of the relationship between Harold of Wessex and William of Normandy, leading up to the Battle of Hastings in 1066, when William became King of England. That's coming up for the BBC. Norton and Kieletzki will be at Series Mania talking about the show, but gave C21's Content London an exclusive preview back in December. Together with Lindsay Martin, Senior Vice President of International Co-Productions and Development at co-production partner CBS Studios. They spoke with Michael Pickard.
Just to start with, it's a story that many people probably think they know, but don't really know much about before the battle anyway. Kitty, what was your kind of interest in telling this story, first of all? Who came and said, let's do 1066?
So it all started with our brilliant creator and lead writer, Mike Johnson, who came to our brilliant and very dear friend and co-exec producer, Rob Taylor, who runs the development partnership. And he pitched this idea. And I think, you know, like I said, and like you said, everybody knows this story, 1066, the Battle of Hastings. And it is both about, you know, how we got there or how Harold and William got there. But I think the brilliance of Mike's pitch to Rob at the time, and the reason that this story had never been told before, at least I assumed the reason it had never been told before, is because people had focused on William the Conqueror or Harold, the great, inspiring, but tragic figure who lost, and separated them. And the key to this show, the beauty of it, I hope, is about the interweaving of these two narratives. And crucially, what I was certainly never taught in school, that they knew each other. So you're not just telling two parallel kind of independent stories. You're telling two stories about their families, about their marriages, which are relatively independent, but also the friendship, the slow build of rivalry after initial respect, then the enmity, and then the battle. And so there are really distinct building blocks through the eight episodes that Mike envisaged approached and we jumped on.
Just in terms of the story, is there a way that you do weave these two stories through, you know, the episodes? And obviously, I'm assuming it culminates in a quite a big battle. So what can you tell us about how we get to that point and perhaps any sort of major themes and things that these characters will sort of face along the way?
We start really at the beginning of their relationship. And following on from what Kitty said, we were amazed, really, that no one had told this story. Because when you do delve into the history, and luckily Mike Johnson is a history nut and loves it, and it's remarkable how close it is to the history. But we start at the beginning of their relationship and we track it all the way until the final battle in episode 8, where their relationship ends because one of them dies. Spoiler. It was a structure kind of ready made for us, really. They meet in sort of halfway through episode 1, the coronation of Edward the Confessor, played by Eddie Marsan. And then there were significant kind of points in history where Harold traveled to Normandy to fight alongside William. There were some moments which were, inevitably in these kind of stories, nothing's contrived too much, but we take a necessary amount of artistic license. But really, as Kitty said, the structure was there. The years from their meeting through to the battle is our template.
Fantastic. And as we've acknowledged, I mean, it's something most six-year-olds are probably taught in British schools. But Lindsay, I mean, it's a pretty epic story. And where do you see the global potential for a story like this, you know, beyond British people who are familiar at least with some of it?
Yeah, I mean, it's massive, isn't it? I think the international appeal and the potential to resonate globally is huge. I mean, of course, it's a well-known story in the UK, but so much of the story takes place in or originated in Europe as well. So I think it most certainly resonates there. And then as Kitty mentioned as well, you know, William the Conqueror, Wessex, these are terms that globally people are aware of, and they might not know everything about them, but there's a sort of inherent familiarity there. So for us, you know, that ticks a huge box. It has really built-in international appeal.
And tell us then, how did CBS get involved and how did you build the partnership behind the scenes?
Yes. Well, CBS Studios were involved as both creative and financial partners in the series. So when the script first came to us, James and Nikolai and Baltazar were attached. The BBC was very keen. I've known Kitty for 10 years. It was a dream team. I think it's the kind of project that you literally dream about dropping on your desk. And then fortunately, the script was amazing. And it really, really blew me away. It has absolutely everything. It has the action, the romance, the political drama, the family. It just, everything's in there. And what Mike has done is so organic. And, you know, he had a really singular vision, as Kitty said. And so did Baltazar. I think he had such a fresh take. And James, as a producer, I think you really had an idea of who this character was and what you wanted to say about him. And this is all just, again, a dream scenario for a studio or for an executive. So fortunately, you know, we're very fortunate at CBS Studios to work closely with Paramount Global Content Distribution. And we brought this to them, as we do with all of our projects. And they were immediately very supportive for the reasons we just spoke about. It's so international. There's massive appeal there. And that made it, you know, quite easy for us to then come on board and say, hey, you know, let's commission a writer's room. Let's get the other 7 apps written and let's finance this series. I mean, we really believed in this team's ability to execute. And I think, yeah, it was an easy decision for us in the end to come on board as partners.
Yeah. And just, can you tell us a bit about the financial model behind the show? Because Paramount have picked up a lot of the fee and the BBC have acquired it. They're not like an anchor broadcaster. So what was behind that idea to, I guess Paramount would just love the show and wanted to get it made and they'll think about selling it later on, I guess.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we're really passionate about the show. I think the package, the creative, as I said, everything really comes together for us. And so, yes, Paramount will distribute the show rest of world, ex-BBC's territories. We already have a lot of interest, of course. You know, it's looking brilliant and we couldn't be prouder of it. So yeah, we'll be selling the show internationally and BBC will have the premiere here.
Yeah, fantastic. Great. And we talked, James, you talked about some of the Michael's sort of research and that history. I mean, how much do we know about what really happened and where would you say the show has taken those creative leaps or how rooted can it be, you know, considering it's over 1,000 years ago?
So obviously we have as much, Mike was incredibly thorough in his research and was really excited when we were able to honor that research and keep as close to the history as possible. And so you have kind of two levels of the story. You have the sort of more, the kind of meta narrative of the battles, Stamford Bridge, you know, the fact that Harold, all of, you know, it was there in the history books, whether or not, I can't vouch for how accurate they are, but we lent on them in terms of the sort of template we were discussing earlier. And then I guess the more creative part from me as an actor and us as kind of storytellers was the domestic space. And what was really important to us was making sure that this wasn't just about Harold and William, it was about Matilda, who's William's wife, and Edith, Harold's wife, and their family units. And that is obviously less documented and but is as important, if not, you know, the most important piece, the engine of the whole story, because it contextualizes these men's journeys, and they're not just on these kind of meaningless grabs for power. They are fathers and they are husbands, and a lot of it is, as I say, is rooted in that more intimate private space. So that's where the creativity and the and really exciting storytelling came.
But there is also actually quite a lot about Matilda and Edith, and not sort of literally what was going on behind closed doors in terms of that domestic sphere, but certainly the plot points that we track with, you know, I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but it is out there. You know, what Harold does to Edith in order to gain kind of political traction. The fact that Matilda was in many ways the kind of puppeteer, she was the educated one and William wasn't. What happened to William in his childhood, how his father was assassinated by someone very close to him and he was on the run throughout his early and teenage years, which informed his very nervous and cynical personality. All of that stuff is actually there. Harold's relationships with his brothers, which were very complicated, and you see in the second half of the series, gets very dark. So actually there was a ton there. But as James says, the way they spoke to each other, the sweet nothings they whispered in each other's ears, that was Mike, that was us.
Yeah. And you mentioned that Balthazar Comico, the director, came on board quite early. So what was the visual ambition behind the series? Because obviously it's a historical drama, but how did you want to infuse, I guess, a modern sensibility to a very old story?
Yeah, he had a really clear vision from the very start that he wanted and needed to be visceral and immediate, and to avoid that kind of ye olde worldy, tight, staid framing. And that was paired with our ability to shoot in Iceland, where, you know, we looked all over, we looked at the UK, we looked at various other parts of Europe. And in the end, Iceland, where Balthazar is also from, made sense to us because of this incredible scale that it afforded us. It could double for Normandy, for other parts of France, for three different parts of England, which all look really, really distinct. For Norway, because of the relationship that Hardrada has with one of Harold's brothers, and it gets involved in the Battle of Stamford Bridge. And Balthazar's vision was both sort of visceral in terms of the way he wanted to shoot it and had real scale. So it was exciting because it felt like it was never going to be a kind of, you know, just drone heavy, pure VFX sort of a show. It would have intimacy, but the way that Balthazar was going to shoot those domestic interior scenes was as kind of meaty as the way he wanted to shoot the battle sequences. In your face, frightening, what it really feels like, rather than just 10,000 men from up above.
Dirty, messy. I was covered in mud for 6 months.
Your fingernails.
Yeah, it was really, I mean, he really did deliver. And actually, we must give credit to their crew out there, because, you know, our costume designer and makeup, but every department really did deliver on Balthazar's vision and brought that home. You know, I was 6 layers of leather and chainmail, and some of them you wouldn't even see. But for me as an actor, it just gives me such...
It would be like one corner of your shoulder, which was an entire layer.
Yeah.
Just so that
everyone was excited about, you know, delivering on that vision. Very, very, you know, true as possible to the, you know, to the history. But and this, as you can, you know, everyone talks about kind of visceral and meaty, but really this does, it does take us into a new space as far as historical dramas go.
I mean, there's a huge commitment to the authenticity, isn't there? And I think that was important to Balthazar and everyone on the creative team. But if that meant, you know, sourcing the exact table from India, you know, that was what had to be done, because it needed to feel very authentic and textural and real.
It was amazing standing looking at my costume going, this piece is from Spain, this piece is from India. And it was really, and it all kind of congregated in this tiny little place in Iceland.
Yeah.
Although the irony was also because we shot in Iceland, what it meant is that we were shooting in builds. They were not, the, you know, these were not ancient fortifications, but that allowed us to actually, it afforded us that authenticity because this sort of tiny squat nature of 11th century homes, or the fact that most of them are in ruins, would have actually held us back. And so perversely shooting somewhere like that, where we could build these incredible authentic spaces, it felt more real maybe than the real thing.
Yeah. I mean, just on that, we've had a question that most of southern England was covered in forest at the time. So why did you shoot more of an alien landscape in Iceland? I mean, I guess you kind of answered that, because you found what you needed in Iceland.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, there are elements of the show that we are playing around with in VFX. So, you know, it will feel very real, but that's exactly it. I mean, even if you think about the difference between Northumbria and what it looks like and sort of much further south, Dover, they are vastly different landscapes even today, like putting aside the motorways and the car parks. And so we had to find somewhere that could encompass all of those spaces, and then, you know, with a little help.
Yeah, absolutely. And James, so with Balthazar early stage, you and Nikolai were also attached to Star. Was that always the plan? Because you're obviously an EP on this as well. So were you always keen to play and play Harold as well?
No, actually. I wasn't initially going to play Harold. Very early on, in the initial conversations with Rob and Kitty and Ed Clark, who was our other EP, in the initial kind of conversation around a table with a one-page pitch, my initial instinct was that I would play William. I was trying to work out with Kitty earlier today why, and Kitty suggested it was because I won, which is probably true. I don't know why I was so set on playing William from
there. That's a spoiler, come on.
But yeah, so, but initially, yeah, certainly in the development process, the assumption was that I'd play William. I think the wily, kind of cerebral nature of that character was attractive to me initially. Mm. And then what happened was I was attached to an HBO show. I was an option for a few series, a show called The Nevers, which then didn't go on beyond its first series. But at the time, we were carving out, alongside my option, what I was allowed to do. And HBO said very clearly, you can go and shoot King and Conqueror, especially considering you're an EP and you're developing it, but you must die because we can't afford you to, you can't risk the if it's a hit and then you end up kind of doing a second series, then there's a kind of conflict. So that's what often happens with actors' contracts. You know, you're allowed to do small piecemeal miniseries, limited, but you're not allowed to kind of commit to anything which has the risk of going on. So yeah, my arm was forced. And actually now looking back, that was very, very early on. That was within the first 6 months of the development process. I can't imagine it the other way around now. William is so, Nikolai is so right for William. I think he would say the same thing. I mean, I loved the journey I went on with Harold, and I think he did with William. We would joke when we met each, when the few times we met each other on set, which were always kind of very charged moments, and we would always sort of go, God, your storyline's so boring, isn't it, compared to mine? There's this constant little competition about how, because we both just really, yeah, we lived and breathed our little family units, and I can't imagine it the other way around now.
And how did you just find EPing while also being, I guess, one of the two leads? Is that something you'd done previously on this scale?
So once. Okay. Oh, twice, actually. Yeah, we made our first movie over lockdown in 2021, which was a film called Rogue Agent, which we sold to Netflix. And then 2023, the last 3 months of that was shooting in Cornwall, the show for ITV called Playing Nice, which was the first time I was balancing EP and actor. And then we had about 2 weeks off, if that, and then we jumped straight into shooting King and Conqueror in January. So it was a really crazy year. And actually, when I arrived on set, my worry was that I hadn't done the work, which I would have usually done as an actor, because, you know, you have a lot of time usually to rehearse and concentrate on the acts and the character and kind of just sit in that headspace and find the familiar, you know, I just like to kind of be thinking his thoughts, and it's the way I prep. And I hadn't done as much of that as I would have liked, because we were literally coming off the back of a show, we were shooting and EPing. And actually, when I got to that first day on set, I realized that I had been in this character's head for 6 years, and I felt more empowered than I had ever done as an actor, because the work had been done for me. And unlike other roles where I turn up and everything's decided for me, I had been in the room around that table deciding on Harold and his journey and his inner private life. So I was more prepared than I ever thought I was.
Great. And Lindsay, I mean, there are a number of voices and interested parties behind the scenes. How do you manage manage, you know, this isn't your first co-production. How do you manage so many competing views perhaps or interests or notes from various parties?
Yeah, I mean, this project was really collaborative from day one. I mean, we did have a lot, there are a lot of producers involved, but I think everyone had a really interesting, distinct point of view. You know, James mentioned Ed, who had been on the project for years and was also very deeply ingrained in the history. Of course, we had James and Nikolai and Baltazar, who were coming at it from such a character-driven perspective as well. So I think it was a really nice confluence of expertise in a way. And I think everyone ended up working really well together across this project.
Yeah, great. We have a question. I'm not sure you'll answer it, but what's the budget?
Yes, I'm afraid I cannot disclose specifics in that area. But, you know, I would say that this, it's probably less than you think.
It's worth saying, actually, and again, credit to Lindsay, Kitty, and I mean, at a certain point as an actor, I was kind of, these guys let me do my job and it was great. But I was constantly, having been on various film sets and TV shows of various budgets, I was amazed at how resourceful this production was. We didn't shoot in blocks. We shot as one block, which was helpful in that we were able to repurpose our sets. But the design team, the art department, these guys, the way it was kind of, it was so efficient. We would shoot out one location, we'd move to another soundstage across the lot, and they would repurpose that for a different set. We would then move back. And so we were because we weren't shooting in blocks, all the directors were there. And it was really remarkable how efficient it was, I thought.
Yeah, yeah. And that's with quite a multinational cast as well. Can you tell us a bit about who else we're going to see in the show and how you kind of brought those together?
Yeah, no, Dixie Chassé cast the show and is a complete dream to work with. And the cast is massive. And we're not just talking sort of day players, meaty, proper roles. It's a really, really long list. So we have Clémence Posey playing Matilda and Emily Beecham playing Edith, who really are our co-leads, as James mentioned. Clémence obviously being from France. Jean-Marc Barr plays King Henry, who is the sort of great friend and then something else to William the Conqueror. Oliver Masucci from Germany, who's a huge star over there and here. We have obviously our very special homegrown talent in King Edward and Edward's mother, Lady Emma, Eddie Marzan and Juliet Stevenson, who were just sort of icons on stage. Luther Forge, who plays James Harold's little brother, who played Prince Harry in the later season of The Crown, is really, really special. Beau Bragson, who plays your little sister, who has a very key role and is married to King Edward the Confessor and having a tough time of it with him. So yeah, it's a really special cast, very multinational. Also a lot of Icelanders who were absolutely brilliant and, you know, local. And as a result, you know, because the show is so multinational in truth, people from all over the world in the 11th century, we have different accents which feel really authentic to period and to the time as well.
So something worth saying as well from the point of view of being in the cast and being there for months and having people come to Iceland and live in this community, there's something very special you get from bringing a cast to a place like Iceland. A, it's a beautiful place and people loved being there and they would, you know, incorporate their holidays, they bring their partners, whatever. But also because we were all there, you know, we were there from the midwinter where it basically is dark, apart from like 3 hours of twilight, through to June where it doesn't get dark at all. It was 24 hours of sunlight, which was challenging and also an opportunity. We shot most of the studio sets in the darkness. And then when we were outside, the DPs were in heaven because we had that kind of magic hour, which DPs love, the kind of hour of sunset is basically 7 or 8 hours. So, you know, we had that sun-kissed kind of magical light to play with as much as we want. But also just, it's a hard thing to kind of define what it is. But when actors get to a place and they're feeling good, and they just bring their A game. And these actors were on fire. There was a really, really strong bond, which I think feeds into the work in a really important way, which you don't get when you're all living at home in London.
And you also don't necessarily get if you're shooting in blocks, in the sense that people were there all the time because they were dipping in, dipping out. We would be shooting episode 2 in the same day as episode 7.
Yeah.
And you mentioned you're doing some work in posts. I mean, how post-heavy is the show? I mean, we see some incredible battles and things. Did you really have thousands of people, or are they all being coloured in as, you know, added in as we speak?
We had a lot of extras. Yeah. But, you know, the Battle of Hastings was, I think it was 7,000 men on each side.
Okay.
So we didn't have that many. But actually, you know, like I mentioned before, you know, there will be, and there's already, in fact, a real sense of scale in those kind of peak moments. But actually, because of the way it was shot, it feels down and dirty. And huge respect to shows like Lord of the Rings and movies. Like, they are personal favorites of mine. But there's no sort of just, we're not constantly panning out to just kind of massive scapes of sort of swarming men, because that's just not the style and feel of the show. You're in it with them.
And what's interesting is, you know, and I think what interested us in the show as well, is that it's not a battle every episode. There are more than one, but they are strategically placed according to best support the narrative. And so that's where we can really focus our efforts in terms of, you know, the post and the budget.
You mentioned a couple of similar-ish shows there. I mean, how would you describe this as being something new or different for viewers who are quite versed in big battles and historical drama, even particularly, you know, Wolf Hall's Combat? It's a very different show, but still it's the costumes and the English history. How did you want to elevate it perhaps to something that would be very fresh for viewers?
I think it is partly what James mentioned. It's the domestic sphere. There's, you know, a really moving kind of through line on both sides, William's side and on Harold's side, that kind of propels you forward in relation to the central marriages, their relationship with their children and with their siblings. And I'm not just talking kind of cozy chats. Really, there's anger and resentment and betrayal that is kind of propelling those stories forward, oftentimes which lead to the bad battles that Lindsay mentions. I mean, they're inextricably linked. And that feels really unique. It's not just a political drama, nor is it just a drama about swords. It really feels like it's both, and there aren't that many of those around.
So I think what's interesting about this is that you've got two storylines which almost could be two separate TV shows, two separate movies. I mean, they are self-contained. And so we don't have a villain and a hero in William and Harold. And hopefully we wanted the audience to be at the end sitting on their couches and be completely torn and conflicted as to who, you know, obviously they know which way it goes. Most people will. But that, I think, is quite a unique structure. You know, within the storyline, there are antagonists of sorts. But Mike, we all were keen to avoid leaning into that kind of stock character. I guess the more sort of the fantasy space, which plays with these kind of more archetypal roles. William and Harold are very sympathetic and both will grab your heart, we hope.
Yeah, so we'll have Team Harold and Team William watching at home. And
I hope so, yeah. That's...
One's going to be disappointed, but they'll probably know that.
I think we'll slightly more Team Harold, but, you know, William will have his spurs.
And just in terms of, you know, the companies you're here with, I mean, Rabbit Track's 5 years now, 5 years old. I mean, why is this an example of, you know, Playing Nice is a very different show? I don't want to go off track too much, but very different shows. I mean, what are you as a company trying to achieve? Where are the stories you guys want to tell at Rabbit Track? And why is this an example, perhaps?
We don't have a kind of single creative mandate. And James and I have been sort of failing to figure out what that is since we started. Yeah, it was late 2019. We raised our finance in 2020. So
it's more like 3 years. Yeah, I mean, it's been a ridiculous. And Kitty produced two TV shows, a film, and two babies in that time. So yeah,
congratulations.
Produced, yeah. It's been a crazy 3 years. I mean, five, yeah, yeah.
But I think really what it comes down to, every time we read a script or a pitch or sit in a room with a brilliant writer, it's a kind of, shit, we've got to do this.
Yeah.
Or, God, I'd never thought about that. Or, you know, some level of shock factor, precisely because we didn't anticipate it, precisely because we weren't looking for that exact thing. It's caught us by surprise. And yeah, to come back to King and Conqueror, why has no one ever told this story before? That was the kind of headline for us on something like Playing Nice, which is about a baby swap. It's a, what would you do in that situation? Oh my God, I can't imagine it. So I'd say that that's sort of the through line for our slate. We also really care about, and this is, I don't mean this in a sort of small, overly pedestrian way, but we really care about family stories, because actually that's the sort of root of what binds us, right? It's how do you feel about your parents? How do you feel about being a parent? How jealous or loving of your siblings are you? All of that stuff. That's what, you know, makes us ambitious or makes us feel shit about ourselves. And I think maybe there's a kind of bit of a theme there for us, but certainly not conscious and certainly not art exclusively.
Yeah, we're not excluding any particular genre. We're open to all. And as Kitty said, if we have that wow factor, that this surprises us and entertains us. I mean, initially we were just led by our tastes, which are luckily usually aligned. And that has basically defined the slate so far. And now we've made enough, we've got enough on our slate to try and unpick a through line. And as Kitty said, it's nuanced characters relating, jostling, you know, those kind of knotty family dramas really excite us. Yeah.
And how are you as an actor, how are you enjoying that step behind the scenes? And are you thinking of projects that you would act in, or are you at one point, will you be producing stuff that, yeah, maybe I won't be in this one?
Very much so. Yeah. I mean, the idea from the very beginning, the company was never about building projects solely for me to be in, partly because, mostly because that's not that interesting to make the same shows for a guy my age over and over again. So for both Kitty and I, it's more interesting to make bigger shows, you know, with different leads, different stories. So at the moment, looking at our slate, we probably have about half of the things which I am in. It just happened that the first few projects I am in, and that was kind of strategic as well, because it meant that we gave the company the necessary kind of supercharge at the beginning, the boost that it needs. But certainly the next few projects we have, which are, you know, getting closer to a green light, I'm in some, I'm not in others. And in terms of why, I love it. I've loved the process. I mean, I dived in slightly headfirst, brazenly, without much experience, and I've learned so much from Kitty and Rob, our partner on Rogue Agent as well. And you know, it's been a real kind of humbling experience as well.
I'm very good at it as well. Really, you're really good at it.
I can say this to a room of, you know, people in the sort of behind the scenes of TV and film, but you know, as an actor, you arrive on set and you're called the talent, and you know, there's messages around the radios, artists to set. And I kind of kept sort of arriving on set and thinking, how creative has my role been today? Like I've you know, my costume has been defined for me, the words I'm saying, the tone of the piece, everything has kind of been prescribed to me. And yes, I have a kind of collaborator, some directors and producers allow a collaboration, but often not so much. And I started to get frustrated. I wanted to have more of a kind of creative control and contribution to the whole. And I honestly, and I've said this in a few interviews, I'm so humbled by how creative the role of a producer and a development executive is. And I don't think they get the due credit, because, you know, the actors are there at the end of the day, they do the press, they do the kind of the front, the articles, they front the show. But the level of importance there's a discrepancy between actually how important they are. And, you know, having been through this process on Play Nice and now King and Conqueror, sitting around that table, literally world building, tone building, finding those kind of really specific nuance when it comes to how we're going to make this a unique show. And, you know, that for me is so creative and newfound respect for anyone in that process of development. Yeah, it's great. Really humbling.
And just Lindsay, how are things at CBS? We're hearing obviously trials and challenges in the business, but what are kind of, how are you seeing things and particularly with co-production, which I imagine is you know, hot at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, we're very busy, and I think it's very much business as usual for CBS Studios. We believe in the power of the co-production. You know, we've released quite a few this year already, and we'll have even more coming up next year, and continue to look for those shows that are both creatively and commercially brilliant. You know, I think for us, its ability to travel internationally is key. We do work very closely with our Paramount Global content distribution to ensure that's possible. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, working with writers and fostering writers and helping them tell their stories and making sure it all works.
Fantastic, thank you. Well, I mean, can we talk about season two? I mean, James might not be in it, but are you planning...
Find a way.
You know, for international buyers, I guess, looking to, you know, for a long-running show, is this something you think, you hope, I guess, we will come back in a prequel or a sequel of some sorts?
I think we'd love to. I mean, it's, you know, still very early days in terms of those conversations, but, you know, it's been such a great experience working collaboratively with this team, and I think these characters are probably, yeah, have more to say and more to do. So we'd love to, if possible.
Fantastic. Great. Well, that's all our time, but please thank the panel and thank you so much for joining us.
James Norton, Kitty Kolecki and Lindsay Martin, speaking with Michael Picard. If you're heading to Series Mania yourself, you can catch up with Mike and Neil there, and we'll have plenty more from the event in next week's episode. But for now, that's all for today. Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest international TV industry news and views by following C21 online, on mobile and social media. My name's Jonathan Webdale. Thanks for listening.